A new stretch of I-69 opens. Will the diagonal highway ever be completed? Organization Day in the General Assembly, Luke Messer's leadership post on Capitol Hill, and the challenge to Indiana's voucher law goes to the state Supreme Court. That plus changes in the Big Ten, at IndyCar, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending November 23,
12. Ice Miller, proud to support Indiana Week in Review. The path to a successful business has unexpected twists and turns. The legal professionals at Ice Miller are dedicated to guiding businesses along the journey. Experience takes businesses to the top. Ice Miller can help them stay there. Ice Miller, it's a complex world. Be advised.
This week, a big stretch of I-69 opened in southern Indiana. Almost 70 miles worth of new roadway are now open to the public. Work on the southernmost point of the project started in July of 2008. Governor Daniels was on his motorcycle to lead a parade along the new stretch from Evansville to Crane. He says this interstate is about more than commerce. It's about making a safer drive for Hoosiers.
A lot of lives have been lost. A lot of heartache has been caused by people trying to get between places in the absence of this road. 40,000 incidents, we believe, will be prevented over the next couple decades alone.
Will I-69 ever connect Indianapolis and Evansville? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike McDaniel, Eric Bradner, State House Bureau Chief for the Evansville Courier and Press, and Leslie Weidenbender, editor for the StateHouseFile.com. I'm Wish TV State House reporter Jim Schiller. Ann Delaney, has the progress on I-69 been a surprise?
No. And I don't think there's enough progress on I-69. I
mean, this stretch came in ahead of schedule and under budget.
That's great, but literally the rubber's going to hit the road is between Indianapolis and Bloomington, and they can't even decide what the route is going to be for that, and there's no money for it, and that's where the traffic is. This may shorten the road to Evansville by, 20 minutes or so from Crane down there, but now getting from Indianapolis to Bloomington is 20 minutes longer. So, the legacy of having this finished, there's no money. The major moves money is gone. So I think what you've got is a nice stretch from whoever wants to go from Crane to Evansville.
Well, they're already
the rest of us are on our own.
They're already working on the stretch from Crane to Bloomington.
Sure.
Yeah. It doesn't get it from Bloomington to Indianapolis. That's where the difficulty is.
Well, Mitch Daniels was committed to this project more so than any previous governor. The question is, when he leaves, does the commitment leave?
No. Mike Pence says he's committed to making sure it happens. John Gregg, as a candidate, said he was going to make sure it happened. So there was a commitment, I think, from both parties to make sure it happens, and it will. It's too important a stretch. It's too important to connect us with southwestern Indiana not to. You got to remember that Evan Bayh and John Mutz in the campaign for governor in 1988 ran on, they were going to build the road from Indianapolis to Evansville, and they didn't. and neither did Kernan, neither did O'Bannon, neither did anybody else. Mitch Daniels actually built part of this road and got it started. Well, but he did it, and nobody had done it before then, and it's going to be a huge economic development boon to southwestern Indiana, and it will save lives, and it will happen between Bloomington and Indianapolis eventually.
Mm-hmm. Eric, what does this mean to the people in Evansville?
Well, it means a lot, but it would mean much, much more if Bloomington to Indianapolis was finished. Without it, it's tough to realize the economic development opportunities that come with this. So when you're thinking about the future of I-69, you got to think about it within the context of the state's finances. The governor-elect is talking about tax cuts, and so funding it out of general fund revenues does not seem like an option. So what else do you have? You can bond for it, you can do tolls, or you can come up with some other creative plan like major moves. Well, taking on debt's not very popular. Tolls aren't popular and would be more than a little ironic. So there's got to be some kind of big idea to get this the rest of the way. There's commitment from Mike Pence, but no plan yet.
Yeah, I mean, That's the answer, right? That this, for this to get done, somebody has to come up with a new idea.
Yeah, this raises the larger issue of whether what the state's going to do about road and transportation funding. And of course, it's not just a state issue. This is a federal, a national issue right now. And, you know, we're already hearing lawmakers talking about finding ways to get away from the gasoline tax, the tax at the pump, which is being eroded by more more efficient cars and by electric vehicles, and finding a way to have a user tax that works in a different way. And there's going to be a lot of debate about that in the coming years.
And you've got a whole section of the Republican caucus that say tax under any circle, even a referendum on a tax, is anathema. So I don't see where you get the support to fund it. So if it,
well, the
it,
one
you know,
thing about roads is they affect every single district.
Yeah, but
if there's
sure.
any place where lawmakers might be willing to consider some kind of tax increase, it's in the way.
But they almost came to fisticuffs in the transportation meeting over that very self-same question.
Not only major highways, but affects every county road and every city road. And I think Leslie's right. You're going to see a major discussion over the next 2 years about how we fund highways and bridges in the state, because everybody knows it has to be done to sustain what we've already built. And Major Moves was a huge part of that, and what we've done not only here but in Northwest Indiana and from Lafayette to Fort Wayne, et cetera, et cetera.
But this can't just be the Indiana discussion.
I know.
It's got to happen at the national level.
A national effort, and because we are changing the way we drive, we are changing the kind of vehicles we use, and so you can't all rely on just the gasoline taxes.
But when it becomes a federal discussion, it's about clout in Congress, and Indiana has much less than it had in recent years, right?
So you need the paradigm to change, right? You can't leave whole states out of the equation because of the politics of the state when it comes to transportation. That's not going to happen. So this is going to be a discussion that's going to have to happen, and it's going to have a major role all across the United States, and it will.
And you're going to have to raise taxes to do it.
Yeah, on the federal level, you've got some Democrats, especially in the Senate, that are interested in penalizing states like Indiana that have leased out miles of highway. So this is a two-track discussion, and Indiana's going to be under some pressure.
And also penalizing states that don't have mass transit with rail, which is something else we're lacking.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific poll question in connection with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question is, should the I-69 leg from Bloomington to Indianapolis be a state priority? Your choices are A, yes, or B, no. Last week's question was, should Indiana secede from the Union? 22% said yes, 29% said no, 49% said can you find a more sensible question? I'll talk to the guy who comes up with the questions. To take part in the poll, just go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. State lawmakers took the oath of office at the State House this week on Organization Day. It was a day for family and friends to see lawmakers go through the ceremonies that accompany their office. In all, there are 29 new lawmakers in the General Assembly, and the vast majority of them are Republicans. The GOP has supermajorities in both houses, yet leaders promised bipartisanship.
We will sit on the floor of this House and in the committee rooms of this building and work through these monumental issues together.
In the coming months, it will be dependent upon us to work as closely together as we can in trying to solve some of the genuine problems for our state. The budgeting challenges will be real.
Also on hand were 7 of the 9 newly elected members of Congress from Indiana. 3 of them started in the General Assembly. Mike McDaniel, how long will the bipartisanship last?
Well, I actually think that there's going to be a good effort to make sure that there is bipartisanship. I think there's a genuine tendency to think that the mood of the public is that it's calling for it. It's kind of hard to see on occasion when you have 69 Republicans in the House and 37 Republicans in the Senate, so they're going to be few and far between. But look, the vast majority of these issues that face the General Assembly are not R&D issues. They're issues that require people from both sides to be supportive, and that's going to continue to be the case, and I think it's going to happen, especially with the leadership that we have now in both houses.
One of my Facebook followers said that the bipartisanship will last until it doesn't.
Yeah, that's true.
Like it's not over to the fat lady's things or something.
Well, but
look, I think Brian Bosma said the right things on this, and if he means it, And if what they're dealing with are the fundamental issues facing the state of Indiana, I think they'll get bipartisan agreement. As soon as they go off the reservation onto the social issues again, that's where I see a meltdown coming. And if they don't exert some control over the Tea Party members of the caucuses, I think that will happen.
Well, don't you think, Leslie, that one reason why you see Brian Bosma and David Long reaching out to the Democrats at this point is to kind of quell some of the radical factions in their caucuses?
I think that's part of it. I also think that with more than a two-thirds majority in the House and Senate, it's going to be easy for them to look like they're being mean to Democrats. And so I think it's helpful to them to reach out. But I also think this freshman class, they're a little bit different than the ones that came in 2 years ago or even 4 years ago. I find them much more open to bipartisanship. I think they're far less partisan, and they seem less angry, frankly, about the elections that just took place. Maybe that's because the Democrats didn't have a lot of money and couldn't mount the kind of attacks on them that they have in the past. But I found a lot of energy in that group.
Well, I think you're right. Both you and I help play a role in orientation for them, and it's not an angry group.
Sure. No, I think Leslie hit the nail on the head when she said that leaders in both the House and the Senate don't want to look like bullies. They have a supermajority. And look at the margin of victory in the governor's race. Mike Pence didn't win by as much as we expected him to. Voters handed Republicans major margins in the House and the Senate, but also sent a little bit of a warning. They know that they've got just enough rope to hang themselves. And Brian Bosma and David Long seem to be very conscientious about the potential for overreach now.
And they're worried that the pendulum might swing back more quickly if they do overreach. All right, the future of Indiana's school choice program is now in the hands of the state Supreme Court. The court heard arguments this week in the lawsuit that challenges the constitutionality of the school voucher law signed by Governor Mitch Daniels. Vouchers are now being distributed for a second year. Opponents argue that they violate the separation of church and state because tax money is given to religious organizations that operate private schools. Supporters argue that the payments are no different than state scholarship money that goes to colleges, including the University of Notre Dame. A Marion County judge upheld the new law earlier this year. Leslie Weidenbender, will this be an all or nothing decision?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think this is a fascinating case, and I think it could go a lot of different ways. I do expect that the Supreme Court will uphold vouchers. I'd be very surprised if they didn't. From what I understand about some of the questions today, they seem somewhat reticent about the impact that overturning vouchers could have on some other state programs. But you never know. This is a court we don't know very well yet.
Yeah, Eric, you were there. I was impressed that a Democrat member of the court, Robert Rucker, seemed to be asking questions from a point of view that he favors vouchers.
He did, and that's why I'm guessing that the answer to your question is it's going to be all, and the voucher law is going to stand. So then the question becomes, what's next? We're starting to see some tangible impact from this. In Fort Wayne, that's one great example where a lot of students are taking advantage of this program, and public schools are saying, look, on this state A through F system, we have better grades, we're losing students, therefore we're losing programs, and these private schools that have lower grades are gaining. So that's probably going to bolster their argument a little bit in the court of public opinion, but it's going to be too late. I think the Supreme Court's going to uphold the voucher law.
And that means the legislature can keep its hands off.
Well, I think they will. I think the program is growing and it's become so popular, and because the money goes to the families and doesn't go directly to any of the schools.
It goes to the families,
and they decide where they're going to send their children, and then it goes to the schools.
The check's made out to the school.
But that's
the family
after
direct,
the families decide where to direct it.
But the money goes to the
school. Money goes to the schools. That's right. And so because of that, I think the Supreme Court upholds this, and it moves forward. And it's going to continue to grow because people shouldn't be punished because their geography keeps them in a failing school. If they want to choose to go somewhere.
Let me just touch on the point of the growth. A little over 3,000 last year, over 9,000 now.
It's the
fastest growing voucher program in the country.
Right. Very popular.
And it has nothing to do with failing schools. You don't have to be in a failing school to qualify. So
right.
The myth that it has a failing school is nonsense. And on top of that, the examples that Brian Bosma gave of people with disabilities, 25% of the students in IPS are disabled in one fashion or another. And many of the people who send their children there don't even live in IPS. because they do such a good job with those students. So it has nothing to do with the disabilities, and it has nothing to do with the failing schools.
It's an option.
And the problem is,
For the parents.
The problem is that the Constitution, that's great to have an option, okay? But the Constitution prohibits state money being paid to church schools. That's the problem,
Yet there have been similar legal challenges to this one in other states that have failed.
Well, first of all, our Constitution is different than other state constitutions,
It's similar.
And number two, you do have judges sometimes who, are looking more at the politics than they are the strict reading of the Constitution. And that can happen, okay? But the Constitution prohibits the using of state money to fund state schools. And I think that the separation of church and state is an important founding principle for this country, and it's being eroded.
This program will continue to grow, and its popularity speaks for itself.
There are three new members of Congress from Indiana, and one of them, Luke Messer, is the new president of the GOP freshman class. Messer was elected during freshman orientation last week, where this class picture was taken. On the far right, you can see two other Indiana freshmen, Jackie Walorski in the yellow and Susan Brooks in the orange. Messer won a campaign for class president that started on the morning after the November election. He hopes to find ways to reduce the partisan division on Capitol Hill.
My goal is to create a set of bipartisan lunches, breakfast dinners, at least meet at least once a month across the aisle with those 79 new freshmen. It's
amazing. Eric Bradner, how meaningful is that leadership post?
Well, if you look at Indiana's congressional delegation, 7 out of 9 members are either freshmen or sophomores, and Richard Lugar's going away. So is an undercard victory like this that meaningful? No, but in jostling for committee assignments and that kind of thing, and building some relationships early on, it's a good start. It's a little helpful, and so the key is, what's he going to do with it? How is he going to position himself to make this matter beyond the first couple of months?
Yeah, what he says is the Democrats haven't chosen their class president yet. He wants to have a meeting as soon as possible, and he's talking about doing monthly breakfast, lunches, or dinners with the 79 freshmen from both parties to try to help people get along. Does that seem like a worthwhile effort?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's just like what we were talking about the state legislature earlier, that sometimes these kinds of things can have a meaningful impact. And, you know, really, he's kind of a nice choice. When he was in the legislature, he got along pretty well with people from both sides of the aisle. And he has the kind of personality, I think, that would do well in a position where he was trying hard to get along with folks with Democrats.
Former panelist on Indiana Week in Review.
Author?
Yeah. It helps explain what's happened here.
He's a good choice. I hope he can bring the Hoosier common sense to this. It's quite an interesting juxtaposition. When Mike Pence was in there, I am the Tea Party, and then you have Luke Messer from the same district saying, let's all get along. I'm all for the let's all get along.
But Mike Pence was in a leadership role when he was there, too. I mean, it's
for a while, until they couldn't take
him. Until he decided that it wouldn't help him running for governor.
That may be what happened.
Another interesting juxtaposition is Todd Rokita, who got a leadership role 2 years ago. And Rokita was really eager to use that to sort of cozy up to Paul Ryan. He was part of that big Republican class, and he was eager to sort of drive Congress to the right. Luke Messer's talking a lot about working with Democrats right now. Two elections with two very different results. I mean, that's...
Yeah. Todd Rokita did set a record for the number of Paul Ryan news releases he sent out when Ryan became the running mate. Is Messer going places?
Well, I mean, it certainly helps to be elected by your peers right out of the get-go. And he is... I talked to him when he was in the State House this week. And he's serious about trying to bring the R's and the D's together, and I think that's worthwhile. And he's talking about doing it on a regular basis. And I think he'll get style points in Washington for doing that in this environment.
What's more impressive to me than just being elected by his peers, because frankly not very many of them really knew him, is that he had the organization to get that done.
Yeah.
I mean, it takes a lot of work to be able to got a whole group of people who really know very little about each other and be the one that emerges on top. And that's a pretty impressive feat.
And that'll pay off for him, because he's the one that they go to when they want to talk to the class as a whole.
Right.
And so he'll be in communication with leadership constantly. So that's going to help him down the road.
Moving on, the Big Ten Conference is growing. Two East Coast universities, Maryland and Rutgers, are joining the one-time Midwestern Athletic Organization. It's all about money. The University of Maryland says the payoff is expected to be $25 million a year compared to $17 million that it now receives from the Atlantic Coast Conference. University President Wallace Lowe sold it this way.
What the membership of the Big Ten does is to enable us to truly guarantee the financial sustainability of Maryland athletics for a long, long, long time.
And that's an athletic program that's been losing money and has financial problems at the moment. Mike McDaniel, is that good news for Purdue and IU?
Well, I think it's good news for the Big Ten General. It's subsequently good news for IU and Purdue, only because if we really end up with four super conferences, which is where everybody thinks this is headed, having those East Coast markets of New York, Washington, and Baltimore that come with having Rutgers and having Maryland in the Big Ten is huge. And it means a lot of money, and it'll be good for those institutions. And academically, they fit in well with the Big Ten. And I think it's going to be good. And they tell me there's at least two more coming.
Is that right?
Before this is over.
You got names?
I do have one of them, but I don't have the other one, but I'm not going to say yet.
Oh. So disappointing.
So do we change the name to the Big 20?
Well, you know, that's what's funny to me. The Big Ten has 12.
Now
the Big
14.
12 has 10.
Yeah.
It's all over the mark, but it's all about the money.
Yeah. Well, and it's about TV money. And the Big Ten Network, a lot of people thought was a joke when it started.
It's a home run.
It's a big factor here.
It's a cash cow. It's a cash cow for those institutions, too. And it's a great, it's good.
What does it do for academics? Anything?
I honestly get very confused by all of this and all of the money. I mean, I think it's overwhelming to imagine the amounts of money that we're talking about in athletics, and very rarely do you hear much about the academic part of all of this coming in. So I really don't have any idea.
Well, I think it's got to be beneficial. If you're attracting attention to your university, that's good, right?
You don't think you're distracting attention from it, though?
From the
academics?
Well, these athletes have to stay eligible. They have to go to class.
They do, but, the money, that's the distraction to me. It's the move for $8 million. It's tough to get much focus on academics. All I know is this might be my Southern Indiana bias showing, but of those other two, I hope the University of Louisville is one of them.
that would affect the academics.
This is also
good sports, though. Good basketball.
This is also good for Indianapolis.
Do you think so?
Oh, I think it's big time good for Indianapolis.
I think it could be really great for Indianapolis.
Because if we keep having the Big Ten football championship here and keep bringing back the basketball championship, having that kind of exposure to these East Coast markets in New York and New Jersey and Washington, D.C. and Baltimore.
But do you worry at all, though, about the fact that the center of the conference, which is sort of what Indianapolis has been in the past, the center of the conference isn't really going
to
be Indianapolis anymore? Do you worry that you end up moving, that you end up losing the tournament?
Nobody has better facilities. I think it positions us beautifully.
And all you have to do is look what happened to Butler when they were on the national stage for 2 years running. The admissions and the quality of the people applying for admissions went through the sky. And that's because people now realize that you have quality institutions where they may not have ever heard of them before.
Do you think IU and Purdue were in that situation? I mean, but
I think to a certain extent, when you're geographic specific, you don't think about going outside your immediate area. And if you find an institution that has a lot to offer, like IU or Purdue have, maybe you'll think about it.
That'd be great.
I can find you kids from the East Coast who have come to the Indiana University because of their basketball program. And the reputation.
Even though they didn't play.
I can also find you somebody who went to the University of Indianapolis thinking it was Indiana University. Finally, there's been a shakeup at the company that runs the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, the Indy 500 and the IndyCar Series. Mark Miles has been named CEO of Hallman & Company. Miles led the effort to stage the Super Bowl in Indianapolis and currently leads the Central Indiana Corporate Partnership. His background in sports includes leading the professional tennis tour known as ATP and the Pan Am Games.
I feel like, in a way, my professional experiences over my lifetime have prepared me for trying to help lead Hallman & Company. I will not be the hands-on day-to-day management of the motorsports business, but I believe I can help.
And Delaney, can Mark Miles turn IndyCar around?
I guess that remains to be seen. I don't really know. I mean, I know what he's done, but I really don't know him. And dealing, it seems to me, with that group of people in the IndyCar is like having egos that you'd have to have, Lucas Oil Stadium to contain. It also gives Mike Pence the appointment of the Indiana, the corporate partnership thing, too, which is an interesting development.
This is a great pick for IndyCar, not just for IndyCar.
Well, when the opening came up, everybody said, well, if you're looking for somebody in town, Miles is the guy, but why would he take it?
Well, but it's great because of his experiences, especially the experience with the tennis, men's tennis. That was a disaster when he took it over. And you can imagine the egos involved in men's tennis and the way it was back then with Connors and McEnroe and everybody else. And he brought that together and made it almost a billion-dollar business. He knows sports. He knows promotion. He knows that these people have to think about the common good of making the sport grow. And he's the one guy that I know can bring those folks together and do that.
Will he's also a guy who likes a challenge.
I think he will get it done.
I think he likes a challenge, and I think he'll do what it takes.
Yeah. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike McDaniel, Eric Bradner of the Evansville Courier and Press, and Leslie Weidenbender of the StateHouseFile.com. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/podcast, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity or Bright House Networks. I'm Jim Shello of Wish TV. We'll see you again next week.
Ice Miller, proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Things can go wrong in 1,000 different ways. Businesses need a law firm that knows the 1,000 and first. The team of legal professionals at Ice Miller is committed to helping put the pieces back together. Ice Miller, it's a complex world. Be advised.